Hey everybody, before we get started with episode 17, I just wanted to remind you to find us and give us a review or comment on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast.fm, Google Play, or Podbeam. In addition, we would like to also have you join the conversation. If you disagree, want to chime in, or just have a comment about my crappy tech skills, Kurt's acronym fiasco, or Chris's dietary hurdles, you can contact us on Twitter by searching at tyonky and by email at cycletyler@gmail.com. And once again, you can also comment on whatever podcast service you are subscribing from. For today's episode, I would like to personally thank Team H24 Herbalife for the chance to sit down with one of their cyclists, Willie Myers, to discuss bike racing and life. As you will hear, Willie is seemingly an untroubled guy, and if you happen to run across him on the bike, you'll be able to find that out in person. What you will hear today is part one of an ongoing chat with Willie. Look for part two coming your way soon. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Today I'm joined, 9/11 today, 2017. Welcome, Willie Myers. Thank you for joining me on the Between Two Wheels podcast. How are you doing today?
Great, thanks for having me.
I'm excited about it. Honored to have you in. We'll get back on your whole life story. We'll start when you're like born and everything. We'll go way back, deep dive. Mm-hmm. But let's start from the top with the last issue with bike racing when you won. Mm-hmm. San Francisco, Giro de San Francisco, right?
Yep, exactly.
Just last weekend. So tell me a little bit about that. Maybe start off. You didn't have a team.
No.
Take me through the whole thing. I did read your blog and I also saw the videos, very very exciting. So
the videos were cool. I added another side.
Just to put that, there were two videos, mm-hmm. Larson and Mikkel, and I actually watched them, timed them up, and put them on one screen next to each other, and kind of watched two different perspectives of the same race, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. Having two videos, one you get to see behind the sprint, and the other you get to see a little more into it and all the sketchy stuff that kind of came along with it. So I had to watch it over and over again just to feel good about myself. But, you know, it was, I don't know. I don't have a GoPro. I've always wanted to make videos for races, but I never have. So I appreciate other people that put the time in.
Yeah. When I watch them, like I'll watch, Number One Beast or something.
Mm, oh, yeah.
And some of these other ones. And you get like kind of the adrenaline gets rushing on the last lap, even watching a race you've done yourself.
Oh yeah. Even if I haven't done the race, even if I've never been there and I'm watching the final like few laps or something like that, I totally enter sprint mode, you know, heart rate gets up and it's
you're kind of leaning with them.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
And I've also found where even if it's a race, I've had a camera on my bike a few times and I'm watching it in the race and I'm kind of like, oh, I wouldn't take that, but it's a different perspective, I think, a camera than being on the bike, too.
Oh, yeah. It feels so much more tame when you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, even when you're just watching a bike race from the sidelines, it seems like chaos. And same when you're watching someone else race. You're like, oh, I don't know about that, or I don't know about that, or why do you do that? It's like, well, when you're in that time, it just flows, and you just do whatever comes to mind first.
Yeah. And it almost makes me think it would be cool if there's any way to have live cameras on the bikes that they can flip to in those kind of moments. I know the Velon is.
Yeah, they're doing it in track. Oh. So they're actually doing it at certain, like maybe at World Cups or World Championships, where they'll have, during track races, they'll have it pop up with their wattage and heart rate and stuff like that. Obviously, it's not as, you know, a track race doesn't have as many dynamics with corners and,
yeah, but
you know,
still
160 people, but it's still fun.
It's not just parameters and all this stuff on there. It's actual the camera video.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know how they do it if they have like extra stuff on the bike.
Well, you know they can do it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a track, so it's not too far.
Yeah.
You know, they're just
right
there.
Enclosed.
But I've seen it a couple times last year where it was cool because they'd have their wattage up and it would just, you know, I would just like facepalm like, oh my God.
Well, with the track guys, I mean, that's not even fair.
No.
What would be cool too is cadence. I mean, those guys, the cadence those guys put out is unreal.
No, yeah, it's they're doing 2,000 watts and 200 k's. Like, oh, that's insane. They're burning out at 40 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just a different sport.
Yeah.
You know, it's like BMX to me. I just can't understand doing that much power.
Did you ever do BMX or?
No, it was not like racing. You know, I grew up doing skateboarding, rollerblading, BMX, stuff like that, but not anything structured.
Yeah, just you have a BMX and you're riding with your friends.
Yeah, you're riding
there's
with
an
friends.
Empty track, you're kind of jumping.
You're like, cool, let's hurt ourselves.
Yeah,
let's
make
fun.
A rickshaw jump.
Yeah,
or something.
Exactly. Yeah. But that was, I hadn't touched a BMX bike in years, you know, but that was, watching that stuff is, I can't even relate to that.
So, you know, I think I've tried when I wanted to get my kids involved in cycling, I was always like, hey, I'm going to get them involved on the BMX side. Mm-hmm. I think it's great. It's fun. And then, you know, you see BMX transferring over to road, you know, yeah. Sprinting and all that. It can be really beneficial. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked out so far.
Nope.
But, and you didn't take that route either then.
No, for me, it was a real roundabout way to get to road cycling.
Yeah.
And yeah, grew up doing BMX and skateboarding and kind of stopped when I was around 18 or 19. I kind of stopped doing everything athletic and I had a big injury that kind of took me out for maybe 2 years.
What was it?
I broke my hip and tore a bunch of connective tissue.
And how'd you do that?
I fell off a cliff. So as I'm sure you know,
someone
this.
Pushed you, right?
No, I just fell off.
Oh.
I'm just an idiot. I was like the Fair Oaks Bluffs.
Okay.
You know, right? Yeah. Right across the walking bridge, there's those cliffs.
Yeah.
And
so you're breaking into someone's house.
Yeah, essentially. I was trying to steal something's everything. But I just was hiking with friends, had to find a way down, and just took a bad line, essentially. Tried to get down this really steep part, just slid straight off.
Is that east of the walking bridge?
You see that big pipe right next to the walking bridge?
Okay.
That's what I broke my pelvis off.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I fell onto that.
Oh, wow.
So I broke my pelvis. I tore a lot of connective tissue and muscles and all that. So I couldn't walk for months. Had no feeling in my legs for a long time. Spent like 3 months in the hospital. And after that is when I started to become a little more athletic. Because I needed to ride a bike to rehab from the injury. You know, so I couldn't really walk. I had to walk with a walker. But for some reason, pedaling a bike was
easier. And you were 18?
I was 18, yeah.
Okay.
So I just turned 18 when I got out of the hospital.
Do you have any trouble running or doing anything like
no,
that?
No, it's the only thing I have still is my hip is really crooked. You know, so even when I'm riding, I sit very crooked on the bike. And, you know, it was just a big impact and kind of turned everything.
So has that caused any other issues with your riding or do you keep a good eye on it?
No, I think I have to have a very specific bike fit. But I think that's about it. You know, I can only ride one kind of saddle, and it has to be exactly where I need it. You know, to like a couple millimeters fore aft, or my body just my back and knees and hips just give out. And I think that is because of the injury. You know, because all the trauma and then 3 months in bed and a lot of rehab just made me a little the hip and back area are a little funny on me.
So when did you get into the cycling? So you hurt your hip.
It was probably when I was 19. Like I wanted to have like a road bike to get to work. So I had an old Schwinn that I bought off Craigslist for like $200. And that bike was great. I wish I still had that bike. But yeah, I rode to work. And then my stepdad, the very avid cyclist, and he convinced me to go do a long ride up to Seattle. He's like, hey, do you want to do this? And this is when I was still...
Ride up to Seattle?
Yeah, we rode from Santa Rosa up to Seattle.
Oh, wow.
And that was my first, like, okay, I need to be a cyclist. So I got a different bike, and I would train on the back of a tandem with him. And, like, we went into the Davis double, which I gave up at 100 mile 80.
Okay.
180, gave up, couldn't do it anymore. Still have unfinished business with the Davis double. But, yeah, through that, I got into road cycling, you know, through my stepdad and then working at bike shops when I got back. Kind of slowly progressed into being a bike racer. You know, at first I said, oh, I don't want to do that. Bike racing looks stupid. And
of course.
It just didn't make sense to me.
So when you first shaved your legs, you didn't have kickback from your family because you said your stepdad
was exactly. Oh, yeah.
So he understood the whole concept.
He was way ahead of me on that.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of helped the whole breaking. You know, everyone knew what was happening already. And I think I started racing at maybe 20. So later than a lot of people, I guess in the U.S. it's normal to start racing in college. So kind of that age range. But yeah, I remember my coworkers got me to sign up for a race and I went and I won. And then that was it. Like I was a bike racer.
So the race that you signed up for, sanctioned race?
It was just an early bird crit. Okay. It was the first early bird crit of the year.
Okay.
You know, so.
Cat 5?
Cat 5, okay. Yep. This was fresh, fresh as can be. So I went to my first crit.
You had shoes, kit, everything?
Yeah, I was working at City Bike Works.
Okay, so you knew enough to not
be exactly. Total threat out there. I was on Team City. Like, I had people telling me what to do. Like, I had trained a lot because I really didn't have much going on.
Yeah.
So I was, like.
You're ready
for I was ready for a Cat 5 crit. You know, and I remember I missed my start. I missed the start in my first ever bike race. I got like 3 free laps. They put me back in. And they told me, now don't attack. Just sit at the back. Don't get dropped again. I'm like, okay. And then it worked out. But it was a good first experience.
So did you know at the time you were a sprinter?
Or
did
no, you have any I thought I was a climber.
Okay.
I thought it was destined for me to go uphill well.
And why did you think that?
Well, So before I like really started spending a lot of time on the bike, I had really skinny legs, and for me when I would look at like the physique of the pro cyclist, yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm skinny, and also the people I was riding with, I could climb well, like I can still go uphill decently but I just at that point I was just doing rides in Folsom, Eldorado Hills and Auburn every day.
Well, yeah, you don't climb like a track rider or something. You
know, yeah, so. Like I can get over a lot of stuff, yeah. You know, but I'm you put me next to like a good Cat 1 climber, oh, I'm done.
Well, I grew up in the Northwest, and mm-hmm. I used to think I was a climber as well. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't a sprinter. Like, I was maybe in the middle. I could climb okay. I could sprint pretty good. And then I went to Colorado, and the climbs...
oh, yeah.
climbers and the climbs were just different. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, those 4, 5, 10-minute climbs that I could be really good at turned into, you know, 15, 20, and they're just ridiculous. Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at climbs that are short.
Yeah.
Like,
you look at, you get those KOMs that are like those 3-minute
exactly.
type of things.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm pretty good at that, but I can only do one. I remember my favorite team camp experience was, I think, 3 years ago. I was just getting ready for a track race, and it was like, I was getting ready for a January track race. I was like as fit as can be in December, and we had team training camp. And everyone was super slow. I was as fast as I was going to be. And the first climb of the day was Salmon Falls. So it's what? Is that maybe 15 minutes or so?
15 is real good. 18?
Yeah, around there. And we were like, okay, we're going to race up it. You know, go.
Is this the one you guys did in the bad weather?
It wasn't great. It was the year after it rained really hard.
Okay.
This year was just kind of drizzly. But I remember I just went all in, like beat everyone to the top of it. Was like got all the glory and then got dropped in every single climb.
The rest of the day?
The rest of the day. So I can go hard once.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
You know, so I have to time that well.
So you have done, that's right, I forgot about that. You've done some significant track racing as well, right?
It's something I really enjoy. Like I really like track racing. I really like the community. And I like that you get to be at a track all day, hang out with your friends, like race a lot. And I feel like there's almost more community involved because you're around each other so much.
Yeah.
You're going to all these races and seeing each other, the same group over and over again. But, you know, to live in Sacramento and want to race the track is really hard.
It is, yet you talked about community, and we have cycling community itself is pretty good. You know, River Ride, the Folsom Rides. I mean, we seem to have some bickering between the two for some reason.
Which
but,
is great.
I mean, it's like, you know, first world problems, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the cycling community in Sacramento is so good. I mean, it's great.
It's amazing they don't have a track here, and they've tried, right?
They've tried for years. I mean, they've been trying since the 80s to get a track here, and it always is like, I think Dino was spearheading the last try, but it just gets lost. Something in there just doesn't work, you know, no matter what it seems like. They'll get half the money, and they'll get the area, but then something will fall apart. You know, like they had the perfect area just south of Howe, kind of just near the traffic courts, and it had everything, and then just fell apart. I think the board gave up. I don't know. But it was like, I was so hopeful that we'd finally get a track.
Because
look at what the River Rider, like look at all the people that live in the flatland. Like what are we good at? We're just good at like pedaling hard for short periods of time and sprinting. Like, oh, great.
But I think it would be great. You know, winter, you know, there's a big contingent of people here. And, you know, I also think it's a good way to get young kids in and just another way of sitting them, you know, because sometimes it's hard to show up mm-hmm. and everything, and this can be a contained atmosphere for them.
Yeah, it's controlled. It's safe. I mean, it's easy to look at parents and be like, okay, they're going to ride around this oval.
We'll drop you off.
Yeah, we'll drop you off. It's going to be fine. It's like summer camp.
Yeah.
But it's just, for whatever reason, the hardest thing to get going. You know, even if you look at other tracks in the U.S., some are doing very well, some are doing bad. But I don't know, you go to a race like Marymore or Alpine or something like that, and like the community that comes out, like everyone's so excited about it. Like that is fun. And it's a bummer that we have to go to San Jose to Hellier, which is a fun track, but it's just so far away.
Yeah.
You know?
And I imagine it's the infrastructure, you know, building it and then, you know, the upkeep.
Yeah.
And whatnot. So you'd have to have a real committed community involved. Yeah. And I know the one, I left Boulder after they had built theirs, but from what I can tell, it's flourished pretty good.
Yeah.
And it might be the fact that, you know, you need a good place. Is it indoor?
It's outdoor.
Okay.
So there's only, I could be wrong about this, but right now there's only really two indoors, if you count Colorado's big tent.
They put a tent on that?
Yeah, they have a big kind of inflatable tent over it, which makes sense. It's the, you know, Olympic Training Center, so they can get good training. But it's that in LA, unless I've missed something, but everything else is outdoor.
So what were your events on the track?
I don't think I raced long enough to really figure it out.
Like, what did you do then?
I did all the endurance events.
Okay.
I really liked Kilo, and I really liked elimination races. Those are kind of my favorite thing. Like, elimination races was really fun. It was obviously hard, you know, it was hard at the end, but it was like a game of positioning during, which I think is fun.
Yeah.
Like, I can position pretty well.
Do you think the track racing transfers over to your road, or your road over to your track, or is it just...
I think being a good track racer is good because it teaches you, well, you can't use your brakes, so I just feel like...
Yeah, float.
You learn to float way better. Because even racing, like racing locally compared to racing, you know, whatever bigger crits is, locally everyone hits their brakes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane.
It is.
And, you know, even at the Giro, multiple times I just said, I wasn't trying to be mean, but I just would yell, like, stop braking. You know, like, you're making this so hard for everybody. Just don't hit your brakes and you're going to be fine. Like, I think I had the lowest average power at the Giro out of everybody, you know, which is, I guess, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I remember Nate Dunn, when he used to look at my power file, he's always like, hey, something's wrong with your computer, you know, these crits, you know, you just, and I'm like, I'm just, it's a different energy in the field. If you know how to get through it, I think, you know, look at the end sprint, then you'll see when I attack, so.
Yeah, exactly. I think I averaged 205 watts
at
Giro, you know, and it was... You know, there are times where you're pedaling hard. You're going hard up the climb a little bit, and you're going hard on the main straight a little bit. But the rest of the time was easy.
So tell me about the race. You had no teammates there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and we'll kind of circle back because you've done some, you know, Tulsa Tough and some of those other ones, and you haven't had teammates there as well.
Exactly.
But I'm sure this, just like you talked about, not having to break, it's different racing in the San Francisco or the Northern California than those.
Yeah.
So you can make up without having a teammate in San Francisco, but not there necessarily.
Well, it's hard because I've done races like Tulsa, and I've done races like Toad and stuff like that with teammates and without teammates. And it's hard because those races are just...
They're tough.
They're just so hard. You know, even if you have teammates, everyone is... Maybe they'll be able to help each other out once or twice, but you're all just trying to be there.
Finish.
You know, you're all just trying to do what you can to be where you need to be. And maybe you help your teammates a little bit, and it's great. And that's the big difference, is when you don't have a teammate at a big race, you know, teammates help, but it may not be the, you know, end-all be-all. When you have teammates at local races, I feel like it's a big deal.
Bigger advantage?
Yeah, because they can control a lot more. They can.
Yeah.
It really affects things. You know, at the same time, you know, because I didn't have any teammates at the race, and the other teams had a lot of people, you know, like Mike Settle had some people, Dolce Vita had like 11 people, you know, the normal squads had people there. I really had no pressure. I didn't have to control anything, you know.
So I also find that tough though at times. You're solo, man, and then they have a big contingent and they can start sending guys up the road, but maybe it depends on what their ultimate goal is. I mean, were they just waiting for Garrett as well?
Well, that was the thing, you know, Garrett, the Mike's Bike Sprinters, he's won that race twice.
Yeah.
And obviously they're confident in his ability, you know, so it was interesting. I went into it saying, I honestly didn't want to hit the front because I didn't want anyone to see me, because then they'd start reacting.
You're not
to
that
me.
Incognito though. Right?
No, exactly. Like I'm like, it's pretty hard to drop.
But I get, like, you just didn't show
moves.
Your face.
Yeah, I didn't want to be covering moves, and that leaves me wide open for them.
Oh, he's really serious today.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to start covering or like countering me.
Yeah.
So I figured there's enough people. If I need to, I'll cover something. I think during the entire race, I had to go up to one move.
Did now I understand there was a wreck that they neutralized the race with 10. Did that really kind of help you in a sense?
Well, it actually it did because I had flatted the lap before.
Oh,
so I double flatted. So I double flatted as I'm rolling back to the pit. First of all, I see the first crash before they neutralized it. There was a crash right before. I'm like, oh, wow, okay, good I wasn't in that. So I'm rolling back, and I realize that there's no neutral wheels. And then I think, okay.
When you say you realize, you just suddenly remembered you forgot to put. Yeah.
I don't even bring wheels.
Yeah. Well, you're right. There's usually neutral support.
Yeah. I just forgot that that was something I had to do.
Yeah.
You know, so I get there, and actually what happened is there was there were a couple neutral wheels, and they wanted to give me one that had a pink kind of commuter tire on it. And I just said, no, I'm not going to run that. Because, like, I don't trust that going through the final two quarters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I'm going to kill everybody if I run that. So
it wasn't the pink. It was the tire itself.
It was the fact that I knew it wasn't an extreme, like, a grippy tire.
Yeah.
That's what was just like, no, I'm fine. So luckily I got some good wheels. But honestly.
And who helped you out with that?
It was Chris Phipps.
Okay.
It was so great.
Nice.
He gave me one wheel and he's like, okay, you're good. And I look, I'm like, oh, I need the other one too. So he ran to his bike, grabbed his wheels off his bike and put them on. In any sprint, there's a chance you're going to crash.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that.
Especially as it's being neutralized because of a crash.
Exactly. Going back to the neutralization, one thing I used to struggle with was losing concentration after you get restarted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I almost would use it as an excuse to not get a result, you know, because, I had bad legs after the restart.
Yeah.
Oh, I had bad, whatever. And I've done that at a few big races where I was really in it until a restart. And then I just lost my head. And so this year, I really tried to practice at every race, every time there's a restart, to be there, like, mentally and still go to the front and still not have it affect me and not affect my result. So when they offered them, they said they were going to restart, I said, okay, great. You know, I went to the front, I put my bike there, and I was very relaxed. And I didn't even know how many laps to go there were. I asked right at the end, like, how many laps are there? 10? Oh, okay, great. You know, it doesn't affect it. It doesn't affect anything I'm doing for this restart, you know, because everyone has to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was fine.
And then, so take me through those last few laps.
Yeah, so I made a plan because it was just, like I said, just me. I didn't have a manager or any, like, we didn't have a plan. So I just said, okay, I'm just going to sit on the back, essentially, which is what I did until, like, 10 laps to go. And then with the restart and all that, I moved to the front. And then, okay, now I'll be serious. And then with 5 laps to go, I decided I'd be right on the pointy end of things. And that's what I did. When 5 laps to go came, I kind of moved into that top 10. And it's pretty easy to stay in that little bubble.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's knows each other there. You know, so it's pretty civil. And I knew if I stayed on Garrett and I stayed on the Mike's Bikes train, they would just be where they needed to be. You know, because Roman Kaloon is their, like, first leadout guy, and if there's anyone I trust to go where he needs to be, it's Roman. So I honestly I didn't have to worry about who to follow or what the plan was going to be. I just said, no matter what, I'm going to stay on Mike's bikes.
Yeah, and looking at the video, it looked like it was I wouldn't say easy, but it was a pretty good spot.
It was
you had the wrong jersey on.
In the grand scheme of things, it was pretty easy because Garrett had some bad luck. Me and Garrett were both on the lead out with, like, 2 to go or 3 to go. You can't really see it in the video, but he ends up trying to go to the inside of the corner. I go to the outside. I get through. He doesn't, and I end up on the lead out train. And he never quite made it back on. He almost does in the final corner, but no one really fought me for it, you know, because Garrett wasn't there. So I just sat on the wheel, and no one really gave me grief. So I just
did. They know that he had.
I don't know. I really don't know. You know, because I see them look back a couple times.
Hide.
Exactly. If they had just seen me there, I don't know if they would have.
And then that's tough for them, too, because, you know, it's not so. You don't want to be jerking their head around, causing trouble at the front.
Exactly.
But at the
same,
and unless Garrett's gone down, their whole thing is, well, we've got to do this, and he's got to kind of come
back.
Well,
that's what it is. Yeah, as a sprinter, you get there.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's just what it is. The lead out's happening, and you get to your lead out train, and. And unfortunately, you know, Garrett didn't make it there because, you know, there's sprints are hard sometimes,
yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
Even going into the final two corners, I was looking around like someone's got to jump me or something has to happen because I'm just this is,
you go down that back section before the last two, and it's usually just chaos as far as just everyone trying to, so you're almost sprinting on the back before you get to sprint on the front.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't look like it was, maybe their pace was just
too much.
They were
going really fast. Yeah. You know, as in, when you're going into a final, like I couldn't tell you how hard I was going, because you're just so concentrated. You're so focused on the sprint that you really don't feel like you're going hard. You don't feel pain. You just are, just concentrated on it. So I think, we were going pretty fast, and only did it become not even sketchy, but, a real sprint is going into the two corners to go, where Matt Meikle went on the outside, kind of like tried to get a jump on us. And it was saying, I heard him coming. I looked over, I saw it, and I just went on his wheel. I said, okay, this is now my lead out. And it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
I just followed him. I got a clean shot at it. And if you can get a clean shot at that last corner, I mean, it's not that long of a straight.
Is that your goal? For me, I always felt it was a long sprint from the corner, like close to three, is it?
It's,
And was that your goal, though?
Come
out of the corner
second.
First or second?
Yeah,
get a little jump.
Exactly. And last year, I came out of it third wheel, and it was close. I mean, like me and Garrett, maybe an inch and a half or 2 inches apart. And so I wanted to be second wheel. I figure first was a little too much because I wanted to use that a big jump out of the corner. But for me, I have a long, I don't often like peter out. I can just kind of hold it for a while. So
if you get the jump to begin with, then hold it. And you came through clear. I mean, it was.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was my first win of the year. So I had a lot of angst going through me to get that win,
So tell me about that. So I looked, and you'd won, Oakland last year.
Yeah.
And it had been a bit of a dry spell.
I hadn't
dry
won
spell.
A race since Oakland.
Yeah, so what happened? What was your psyche with that all year?
Oh, God. It's amazing how stuff like that can get it, even when it doesn't matter a lot of times. It completely gets in your head. Because two years ago, in 2015, I won a bunch of races. I think I won like eight races just near the end of the year, and I was like, it felt not easy, but things just came together really well. And then last year, I had a great season and won a lot at the end of the year. And to have a beginning of the year where I really wasn't getting results, it was like surprisingly hard to get over. Okay, I haven't won anything. Like in my head, I haven't won anything this year. Am I going to go a year without a win? And I don't know why, but that's always been a thing I worry about. I always worry about that all winter and at the beginning of the year.
Get one early so that you're kind of monkey off your back.
Exactly. That just takes the pressure off. Okay, I'm good enough to do this.
Yeah.
I'm good enough to do these races.
Are you, coach back in college had said before, and it was the first time I'd really thought about it, but it's always stuck with me, and I'm sure everyone else has thought about it too, but it's separating your results and your training results with your personal. I'm a good person, or I could be a horrible person and do good results. Mm-hmm. And you always see this, like you're in a race and suddenly, your buddy or someone wins and they think they're the shit.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, you're still the same douche I was just hanging out
with
yesterday. You're not, you won. Okay.
Yeah.
And, or if I win, does that mean and so that's.
It's surprising how much you can put into a local race result. Like
even
in a group ride. Yeah. I mean, I remember
River Ride World.
I don't do River Ride Worlds for that reason. It's funny that I won't do it.
Yeah.
But there was a year where.
That's how they get a winner like last year.
Oh my God. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
But it's just, it became almost too stressful where I was like, I put so much into winning just group ride sprints.
Yeah.
It became stressful. And actually we can talk about this later, but that's why Jackson was a little funny for me. I don't know if I was willing to put, lose Jackson in a sprint. So I just got dropped.
So yeah, let's talk about Jackson.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. I didn't end up going.
Oh, it was such
I feel
a great
actually
race.
Really bad about it
because
it looks like a great course and the fields weren't big at all.
No, it was really small and it was kind of a mix between like Cats Hill and the Auburn Crit.
Oh, okay.
It was a really big. It was because the hill was like Cats. It was really steep. I think it was like pitched 23%, and it was about as long, maybe a little longer. And then you had a kind of a technical run in with a hard downhill left into a hairpin, kind of like Auburn. Where we had that hard downhill left into a kind of a little bit uphill finishing straight. And I did it because I'm glad I was pre-regged. My team had pre-regged me or I wouldn't have done it. I woke up and was like, oh man, I have to do this race. Sleeping in sounds great. But because I was pre-regged, I went out and did it. And I think our field was maybe only 20 people.
Yeah.
and there was four mics in it and some other people. But I mean, it was great. It was kind of brutal, you know, because you had this, I don't know how long the climb was, maybe 15, 20 seconds of going absolutely ballistic and then kind of pedaling easy and then attacking out of the hairpin. So it was something we don't get a lot of in Northern California. You know, it was kind of one of those races like Nevada City or kind of like Santa Cruz.
And it was a downtown.
Yeah, exactly. It was a cool downtown race.
Were there very many spectators out?
No.
I mean, Jackson probably.
There were some people wandering around. Like, there were some bars on course. So people were watching outside. And then on the hill, there were some, like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 people heckling us, which was nice. You know, it was, like, people in Jackson seemed really happy that we were there.
That's always good. Do you have any, I think those are the most awesome kind, you know, the downtown and Auburn, Cats Hill, mm-hmm. Santa Cruz. And, you know, we have a lot of business park ones, which you need as well. If you want to have a lot of races, it's fine. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, someone like me doesn't actually show up to them. But is there any ideas you have just of how do you maybe, you know, I was talking to Kurt about this yesterday mm-hmm. and thinking of maybe doing something where you just really advertise the Pro One race. Like, that's the spectacle. Maybe you get it where you start doing entry fees for, you know, top teams, mm-hmm. Just even their main guy, you know, like you got registered, you'll show up, bring a teammate. You know, mm-hmm. it's just free reg.
Exactly. Well, that's, you know, you look at how the bigger races are, and that's how a lot of it is you have, you know, the evening races are usually, all the categories don't race. You know, sometimes it's just a threes, a master's race, maybe a junior's race, the women's, and then the one-twos or ones.
Like San Rafael just only talks about the main event.
Exactly. And that's because that
I'm
is...
I'm not saying that you shouldn't talk about the others, but...
But that is what draws a lot of the people.
Yeah.
You know, that is the twilight race. That is kind of the thing that is the most exciting to watch.
Have you done Boise?
I have done Boise.
So I did Boise way back when I was... And it was... That was the only race they had that night. And I don't know if they do more now, but it was just the P1 race. And I think I've told you, the money was crazy. It was a $100 preem every lap. And this is in the 90s.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. They even had a backside preem of the fastest.
Another less money.
There's less money. And it would be three deep. They'd have that parking structure. People just crowded in there. Mm-hmm. And it started late at night. And, you know, ride your bike back to the hotel with a bunch of money in your jersey. And you're scared to death. But it's Boise, so it's no big deal.
Yeah. Races like that are something we're kind of missing. You know, we're missing that, like, Boise, that Tulsa, kind of that electric vibe to it. I mean, Santa Fe gets pretty close. You know, we have a lot of people out there, and that's the closest we have to something that's like a spectator-friendly race. You know, because a lot of the races, like you mentioned, like the business park and kind of 80% of the races we have, or probably 90% of the races we have, are just in the middle of nowhere where there's no spectator anything, except for the, you know, families and friends and stuff like that, which is fine, great, go race, but it brings a whole different kind of energy to a race to have people actually watching you race, you know. So just that little additive of like wanting to animate and wanting to like put on a show kind of thing.
We did a race in Fitchburg, one of the stages was like through a college sorority building up this climb, and it was, you know, they're all out there drunk and crazy mm-hmm. and screaming. It's great until you're popped off the back, but even then it's fun. And it's I don't know, do we have a lot of towns and businesses don't like it because they're exactly.
I mean, this is a very small race, but it's the same thing as Coppertown Circuit Race.
Yeah.
They had to take out that little square that you usually race through because the businesses didn't like it. I mean, granted, there's not a lot of spectators. So
which is interesting because you wonder if those businesses, because you're locked in there. Everyone's buying food from that barbecue place.
And the ice cream spot and the coffee.
And do they do that much business otherwise?
I mean, I don't know. It doesn't make much
sense.
It's
such a weird thing out in the middle of nowhere.
It's like really Oasis. Is. It's bizarre. It's like a movie set. You know? But
Truman Show or something.
Exactly. And I think, I don't know, there's definitely a disconnect between like business owners in downtown areas and the people that want to see a bike race. Because I've always thought, how amazing would it be if we had a downtown Sacramento race, you know, like on K Street.
They did have one a few years ago.
So that's
did you ever do that?
Well, I did SACGP. Yeah. Okay. So I
is that what it was
exactly
called? I went and watched it. It was when I was
around
still
the
fat.
Capitol. Yeah. And it was fun. Like, it was great. Yeah. There's a lot of people.
Yeah.
But honestly, I feel like if you moved more into Midtown, you'd have that more of the crowd. Because there's a, like, I don't know. I feel like it's more fun to animate a race and completely blow yourself up in front of everybody than it is to get like 12th place. You know?
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of races whatever at Toad or at something like that, where the whole plan would just be attack until I couldn't anymore. If it worked great, you know, and then you had a great time and everybody saw it and anybody had something to talk about afterwards. We don't have a lot of that in Sacramento.
No, and you know, if you moved it out, you don't have to necessarily be around the businesses. It could be around some of those local, but you know, the people that live there.
It's hard.
They're discombobulated for a few hours of the day and they're freaked out.
But that's going back to the having fewer categories and having to be a really, you know, only a few races, I think, is the way to do it. Because then you don't have to shut it down for an entire day.
Yeah.
You shut it down for 4 hours. Yeah. You get to see the spectator side of things.
Yeah, and going back to that Boise, so they had that. Yeah. But then that was Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And the day after, as a matter of fact, the first race I ever did was there. And that was, you know, off the ways and it had all the categories and no one should. And I'm like, hey,
is that Littleton?
Huh?
Is it, or so there's, I remember there's some good race after Boise still. But sorry,
well, it was right in town. It was just a few blocks away.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
I don't think they have it anymore. Okay. Matter of fact, it was, when did I do it? It was in the 90s, and I won something, and it said, support your, like, 88 Olympic team. You know, it had been in a shop for, like, 10 years. You know, like, it was a cutoff jersey or something ridiculous. But my point is, they had, hey, you come and watch that. You watch all the big guys, and the next day you get to go do your thing, and it's your typical, you know, crit.
Yeah.
And that wasn't such a bad idea.
Exactly. They have, like, Grand Fondos. A lot of these big races, and these NRC races, or even big crits, have a Grand Fondo, because that's how they fund the races, and they also get, like, a more people out to these events, you know, where it's the kind of community side of things. Like at Cascade, they have that mile run. A Cascade between the women's race and the men's race, they have like a pretty big money run.
In town.
Exactly.
They do something like that. I don't think it's related, but it's in Chico. They always have a running race that morning.
See, like stuff like that, which is, instead of just being a bunch of bike racers having fun with other bike racers and like no one really cares, it brings more people into it, you know, which I think is something that's extremely important. You know, like making a community event like a lot of big races do that we just haven't quite figured out in Sacramento. You know, so that was one thing that was fun in Jackson is maybe it wasn't great, but I just kept trying to make it fun. Like, I'll just tack on the hill every lap or something like that.
Well, you had your win the week before.
I was talking to a friend after the race, and pretty much what happened is with like 3 laps to go, I really didn't have it mentally to say, I'm going to go all in for this race. You know, there's a guy solo up the road. He'd been up the road for like 45 minutes. He was almost lapping us. Like, the race win was gone. I felt like I didn't have that many more mental bullets to say, okay, I'm going to go ballistic for this.
Are you doing Oakland?
Exactly. Oakland is going to be the last race. Obviously, I'm completely committed to that. Like, I love that race. That's our district championship.
So yeah. It's how many times have you won that district?
Twice. I've won districts twice, and I've won Oakland twice. Okay. So I've won Oakland the last 2 years. And it's just it's like a perfect crit course. It's a figure eight. You have two little hills in it. You have not a hairpin, but a pretty tight corner. And it's a fun race. And it's one of those races where people will come out and watch.
Yeah.
You know, the Bay Area community will come out and watch. So it's a little more fun.
How was the San Francisco race as far as crowd and also like participants? It seemed like
it was pretty good. I mean,
how big was your field?
I think it was, I honestly haven't looked, but I think it was like mid-60s.
Okay.
You know, so what you'd expect from like a kind of a bigger local race.
Yeah.
It could have been more, I honestly don't know, but which is great. I love bigger races like that.
Yeah.
You know, the bigger fields just makes it, I feel like, more like a normal race.
You went down in Davis.
I did, yeah.
And you broke your wrist, is that right?
Yeah, I broke my scaphoid.
It seems like the participants in that one have been kind of going down as well.
Which is odd, and I couldn't really figure out why, because there's really nothing going on. It is very hot. It's super hot. But the crowds are huge. I mean, it's Davis.
Was it still a good crowd this year?
Yeah,
I didn't even see people
great.
Like me aren't even showing up.
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of my favorite races of the year. Because that's like my parents will come out to that. And it's just a big community event. And then I've won it. So it's like, oh, I got to go do it again. But yeah, it's always hot. But I honestly couldn't tell you why there weren't a lot more people out racing it. You know, people always say, oh, it's sketchy. There's all this bad stuff that happens. I mean, but it's not. I mean, I didn't crash due to sketchy.
Which way did they go? A few years ago, when they they went the other way, and they had that mattress on the backside.
That was great.
And I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He rode with...
There's a bunch of crashes there.
I don't know why.
Like, it didn't make sense to me why people were falling over.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's people we getting
going,
scared.
And I did the P1 that year, and I think we're going like 4 or 5 wide through those corners. So, yeah, I mean that's
it wasn't fast enough.
Exactly.
You know that's a big thing that makes those races.
You need it strung out.
You need it strung out because you can't go that wide through those bumpy turns.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what makes it like sketchy, I guess, is it what you could say? But I mean, what, I crashed out of the breakaway, so I have no excuses, you know, like.
So how'd that happen?
It was just a classic racing incident, you know. It was like 3 laps to go. It was a pretty big break. So there were enough people to have funny things happening. And basically, I think someone attacked. And
you had teammates with you?
I had Matt Chat.
Okay.
So Matt Chat along was in the break with me. Like, dream scenario. And I was on his wheel. It was getting pretty hard. We were moving up. And as we were moving up, one of the other people in the break, who's unspecialized, moved left as we moved right. And he was, you know, moving left to avoid those huge potholes. After turn one, you have all those potholes, which take a bunch of people out. So he was moving left to avoid that. I was moving right to get ready to take the corner, essentially. And it was, we just ran into each other. You know, like I was furious at the race. I mean, I was standing in the middle of the race as they came by yelling at him. And even like confronted him after the race, but I ended up calming down. But I don't know. I broke my wrist with 3 laps to go. And then in the final corner, Matt crashed and broke his wrist. So I was like, well, that was the worst possible scenario to come out of that. You know, but the reason, I mean, going back to people not coming out to races, I feel like this has been the lowest amount of people I've ever seen in a bike race. Like, this whole year.
Yeah, I felt that way.
No, like, no one at a lot of races that are fantastic local races.
And I mean, I put myself in part of the, I don't want to say problem, but I've done less racing this year. And it's just family stuff for me. You know, we've even talked about, there's so many races, and sometimes you start the season, you're all gung-ho, and by, you know, March, my family's kind of like, eh. And I've given up a day for Snelling when I should have, like, saved it for Cats Hill, you know, something cooler. So
yeah,
and that's just my own personal.
And for teams, you look at teams like my team and the Echelon squad, Stork CCN, they both our teams really don't do local races anymore.
Yeah,
you know, this is the first year that Herbalife hasn't paid for local racing. We are paying for a little bit, but not
so
all of it.
So what's the main gist of their push for racing for you then? Like,
well, it's saving all of our budget to go to travel races.
Okay.
You know, like right now we have a team in China for Tour Poyang Lake. Originally I was going to go do it, but I decided not to at the last possible minute. But so we decided to do more races like that. You know, this year we did, I don't know, I'm going to probably miss a bunch of them. We did, you know, Chico, Redlands, Tulsa, Toad, BC, Cascade, I mean, Puerto Rico.
That's right.
Yeah, that was a great race.
Yeah.
We did a race in Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and China, and then we're going to go to Trinidad and all these fun travel races instead of doing, you know, putting all of our budget in the local races.
Well, maybe that plays into your results then. I mean,
you're
not just racing, you know, the Folsom Classic and
exactly. Land Park. This is the fewest local races I've ever done.
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, it's fun because I get to go, you know, live in a van for 3 months and it's exciting. But at the same time, you almost forget how to do those local races. And for me, to win a local race early in the season specifically is like, okay, I can do this. Like, I know what I'm doing. It's a good, like, mental check. Even going to the big race is like, I can compete, I can do this, here we go, kind of thing. So yeah, I had some not great but like decent results at the bigger races, and I felt like I raced really well, better than I ever have, but I didn't win, you know. I didn't,
well, maybe they helped you, you know, win solo at, well that's without the, a team at,
exactly,
at San Francisco then.
Well, you know, that's always what happens is I'm usually pretty good at the end of the year. Usually August and kind of September is my best fitness because I come back from all these travel races and I've just raced for 3 months, you know, and I'm ready to go. Granted, breaking the wrist did hamper me a little bit, you know, not a huge amount. I had to take 2 weeks off. I still tried to race BC with a broken wrist and it was fine. I think I raced 4 or 5 days, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I had to pull out. But so, you know, having to do 2 weeks off, 3 weeks off, and then come race locally, it kind of took me out of my groove a little bit as another hit to my, you know, already very shattered ego.
Yeah, and if you had had your, well, maybe it kept you hungry. I don't know.
It was. I really wanted to win something because even at Sassoon Harbor Crit was a few weeks before Giro. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks. And I went into that. That was my first race in about a month and a half. And I went into that just not even saying, I'm going to win this race. It was, okay, let's just be in a race. Let's just race your bike and see what happens. And when the time came time to sprint and try to win the race, I just didn't. Like, I didn't even try to win the race because mentally I was just hadn't gone into it saying, I'm going to win. I went into it saying, I'm going to have a good time, race my bike. So I didn't win, you know?
It's interesting, you know, like your position. You go to do a crit, and unless there's a break up the road, you are expected to be in the mix.
Yeah.
And that could be stressful.
It can be very
because,
stressful.
Because, you know, you got your other friends who, they don't have a chance. And, okay, they'll try off the front, and maybe it's that half-assed two laps to go. It's
but they get still good. They got to do their thing. And that's good.
Or they drag you up to the front, and so that's great. But you've got that stress. Okay, I have to. Otherwise, what's your day?
Exactly.
You're sitting here telling me I didn't have it. And that's, they may not have had it, but they maybe look like they won a premium or something.
Exactly. And that's one thing, not really this year, but last year, even just the local races, I'd have like an 8-man lead out. You know, yes, like last year at Giro, I had an entire team.
Yeah.
We controlled the race. We brought the break back from like 15 to go. They were on the front until like 2 laps to go. And I just sat there and I was sitting behind them, watching them all just destroy themselves, just thinking, man, I better win this race.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not like they're all made the effort to get here and train and do all this just so I can sprint. You know, it's like, oh man, that's a lot. That's a lot of stress. And I've actually had kind of completely lost it at bigger races. I remember 2 years ago at BC Super Week up in Canada, I had a full lead up for me on the race that I was really targeting. And I just completely lost it mentally. It got to the point where, you know, I didn't get
like during the race?
During the race and after the race, you know.
Well, walk me through your losing it. Is this?
So basically it was the Ladner Crit, so it was day two. Last year, I had been in really good position in the final corner and crashed and got myself in the hospital. So I thought, okay, I know I can do it here. Like, I know I can. And so I had, like, the perfect lead. I had Tim Rugg and then Josh Carlin and Matt Chat and myself with, like, you know, in the final, like, in the final 10 laps or so. And Tim Rugg is, you know, extremely, like, knowledgeable guy. So he was basically leading me out how he thought he should do it, and I didn't think it was how he should be doing it. I was yelling at him, and communication completely broke down. I lost my lead-out train, and we ended up finishing in the order of our lead-out train. It almost perfectly. You know, it went Josh, then Matt, then me. You know, it was like, I think we were even like one person apart. And all that stress of like having a year of wanting to do well at that race and it not working and knowing that the team had worked for me came out as me yelling at everyone, essentially. And like Michael Jasinski was there and he had to calm me down before I just rode off into the dark. And it was raining. I almost rode in the dark home because I was so shattered emotionally.
So did you end up working all that out with him?
Yeah, it ended up being fine. You know, I think me and Tim Rugg yelled at each other multiple times over the couple months we were together, but it always ended up okay. But honestly, that trip just didn't, it never, nothing clicked.
So what do you want for a lead out?
You know, honestly,
compared to what was he doing? And not to throw him under the bus at all, but
no,
you know,
he wasn't really doing something wrong. I like to sit really far back. First of all, I like to be myself until the very end. I'd like to find my team with like 2 or 3 laps to go because I'm pretty good at just like working my way around. And I wanted them to be on the far outside because it was the least stressful place to be because it was raining. You know, it was raining and the final 2 corners were over brick. So I didn't want to be diving the inside over and over again, which is what we were doing. And it was working. He was keeping us in the bubble, but I kind of kept getting whiplashed off the back and I'd lose the train and I'd have to get the train again. And it was complete.
That's not your focus at the time. You did not want to be worrying about
it. I didn't want to be worrying about it. I wanted to just be worried about, you know, staying in that bubble at the front. And, you know, when the sprint comes, great. But I ended up using all of my, maybe not physical bullets, but mental bullets, worrying about the lead out instead of worrying about the sprint. You know, so basically when it came down to go for it, I just wasn't there. I already crashed twice in the race, and I just lost it mentally, which is a bummer. So that can be a problem with having a full team behind you, is it adds a lot more stress.
Yeah. I saw online a few weeks ago, and Lars Boom comes across the finish line in the brink bank, and he gives the arm salute, basically the big F you.
Yeah.
Have you ever, speaking of, you're kind of going off the rails, have you ever done anything like that? Or do you even, what's your best salute coming across the line to?
Well,
or do you think about it?
No, I've never thought about it. I've never once.
Well, kudos to you for not having to think, be a reaction.
It is. I've never had something to say, okay, I mean, if I win this race, I'm going to do this. At Giro, it was like
total elation.
Exactly. Awesome. I was like, that was a year of wanting to win a bike race, and I won a bike race, you know. And but even before I crossed the finish line, I didn't know what was happening, you know. I think probably that finish line celebration was my favorite. I've had some other ones, like the first time I ran Davis was really good, because that was the first race that I won in front of my family, like my mom and dad were there and all that. That was a really good one. But I used to have just a really pathetic victory salute, where I would just like kind of put my arms up and like look
nonchalant, like,
wow,
look
at that. And then for some reason, I think I realized it was okay to like let it out a little bit, you know, let it out a lot.
Yeah.
And
I think it's good for your teammates to see your, you know, hey, this is maybe not like expected. It is, but
it still matters.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. This might be, people might hate me for saying this, but I don't really like when Peter Sagan wins, because it seems almost too casual for him.
Well, yeah, he's able to do it in a manner that he is thought out little
exactly.
baby or
and
whatever, the hula.
It's like, well, especially in a sprint, I feel like if you're on a mountaintop finish and you have some time to think about it, and you can, it's a little more slow, but in a sprint, you don't know if you're going to win until half a second.
Yeah.
Maybe even less before you cross the lines. There's no thinking. But I remember when I watched him, Sagan, win Worlds at Richmond, he just kind of like put his arms up. And I'm like, man, that's not right. Like, I want to see, like, you just accomplish what you've wanted your whole life when you win a bike race.
Yeah.
You know, that's like when Lars Boom he was by himself, and he still was so, he had so much emotion coming out of him.
Well, and I watched the video a while back, and mm-hmm. he comes across, you know, he's F you this, you know, his mouth, you can see it, and then he's striking the arm, and then he takes the bike and the handlebars, and he starts kind of jumping it up and down, like he's jumping, just bang, bang, bang.
Mm-hmm.
And like, is he a lot of frustration coming out?
It was
or
just
angst,
all I did was, you know, read the story.
Yeah.
But from, he didn't have good results, he didn't have the results he wanted to, and when you have that, even if you don't show it externally, you know, it's like that, it builds up hard, you know, like the expectations of doing well and don't do well, it's just like every race gets more and more and more, so it comes out like that. Like I
have you come across the line in a situation, so you know, your win at San Francisco was mm-hmm. more elation,
yeah,
and but have you been like so frustrated, let's say you had won that day when Tim Rugg
mm-hmm.
right,
Tim Rugg, yeah,
wasn't doing what you wanted to, and you're frustrated but you win, are you going to have this anger, have you had the anger side wanting to come out, or is it like, hey, it's all gone, I just won?
I don't know if I've ever really been angry. Like, I think, you know, the winning takes over for a second. You know, I've never looked back at who got second and was like, ah, F you. I don't think I've ever had
that's
that.
That's too bad.
Yeah, no, I really need to be more aggressive. But
no, I'm saying that about, you know, there's some people you beat that you just don't like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Probably not locally. But
well, the thing is, locally, I'm friends with everybody. Yeah. You know, there's not anyone where
there's always that guy, you know, you're saying you got crashed out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's always that guy in the race and for someplace, and he's just... You ever get there where you're, no matter what you're doing, you're moving up and the same person is riding like an ass in front of you? And
oh,
like,
yeah.
And then at some point I'm like, how bad am I that I can't get rid of this guy?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Every race, there's like different areas of the country that I have these people in. I won't name names, but if I am not beating these people, I'm furious.
Yeah.
You know, if I've gotten dropped in a race, at BC I got dropped in like two of the races. I was just, maybe three of the races, I was just dropped. And... you know, I can make excuses and say, oh, I had a bad hand or whatever. I'm like, I probably just got dropped. Yeah. But, and then I see people in the race, and I'm like, I know I'm better than them. And I just was like, oh, man.
See, and this goes back to what my coach was saying, too, right? And that's a struggle.
I hate them for some reason.
I hate them, and they're beating me. And, am I a worst person, and am I going to flog myself tonight?
When I remember my first big trip that I did, I got in my minivan, my like 97 Chrysler Town and Country, and I drove across the country.
The
and
wood paneling or anything on it?
No, but it was like the total. Yeah. It was like the nicest like soccer mom van. Yeah. Electric seats.
Okay, so you went out in style.
Oh, yeah. No, it was good. And I drove across the country by myself. You know, I did, I think, like 12 NCC or NRC or whatever you want to call them, crits. And I remember the first, I mean, I was getting dropped in like every one of them. This is my first year as one. And it was kind of trial by fire for myself to go out and do those and live in a minivan and live off pretzels and V8 juice and do those races.
Stop at the come and go.
Exactly. No, that's really what
I had
was.
To take a picture. Of that. Have you seen those?
Oh, yeah. That is the
I'm like, that's not a real name.
Like, yeah, exactly. This is a joke, right? No, this is real. Okay, great. But I remember, did you ever race the Belmont crit? It's after Shell. I think it's Belmont. It's after the Charlotte race. But it's hard. You know, it's kind of half uphill, half downhill. And it's one of those races where, you know, I had gotten destroyed the day before. I was like, gosh, I just want to finish. Like, I just want to finish this bike race, you know. And I remember I tailgunned the entire day. And I think there was like 140 starters or, you know, something. It was a big race. Yeah. And every time I saw someone on the side of the road, I was like, you know, just like, F that guy. I'm so much better than he is. Like, oh, look at me go. Look at all these pros. I'm so good. And that was the only thing that got me through that race was just like, was just making like completely arbitrary, like just rivalries with these people that I had to last longer than they did. And like, I think 42 people finished the race. And I know that because I got like 42nd place. And that was the last person in the group. But yeah, the only thing that gave me through the race was watching all the other people that didn't finish.
You know, I did a, we talked about this on the bike before, Super Week, mm-hmm. You know, those 100K crits.
Oh, my God.
And I think one of the last days, Whitefish Bay, one of these, and it was one of those things, right? There's Tour de France guys that come over, and they're mm-hmm. bailing out. Who knows what? But I'm thinking I'm great because I finished this, mm-hmm. and it's awesome. And, you know, I think I got like 25th or something. So it's just, oh, it's awesome. But you really think about it. Chris Horner was in that race that day, and he lapped us twice.
Yeah.
So while I'm excited about this, you've got that situation going on.
I had at the same race at Super Week. I think I had told you. I went right as a fresh two because they were 1-2s races. So I could do them. So the second I got my Ket 2 upgrade, I drove to Wisconsin with my friend, and I raced. I can't remember how many. I think I raced 8 of the days. 8 of the, like the 20 days.
Yeah.
And one of the days, I just wanted to finish. You know, like 100K crit. It was really hot. I was like, the entire race I was just thinking about finishing. And then when I zoomed out after the race and kind of figured out what happened, yeah, one of the Hong Kong national guys who was scratch race world champion on the track had lapped us solo and then attacked, gotten a half lap up on the field and just won it solo, like a lap and a half in front of me. And I was just suffering. I was like, oh my, like I couldn't have handled, if someone told me that in the race, I would have pulled out. You know, I was having my own battle of just finishing, and this guy is just that much better.
But that is what's fun about the sport, too. You can have your own little, you know, moves up and accomplishments, and, you know, and then see not North Korea.
Yeah, no, that was not the North Korean national team. No, but it was just so different, you know, and it was like, I've been to many races where, like, you know how it is. I'll go to a race where I really expect to do well, and if I don't do well, it's really upsetting to me. But then if I go to a race, I don't know, like the first day of BC is a really hard crit. You know, it's half uphill, it's half downhill, and it's always just brutal. And I always go into that race just thinking, all right, well, here we go. You know, like I'm going to give it everything I've got. I've almost made it at that race before, but I don't come out of that race upset with myself. You know, like
expectations are set,
right? Exactly. Like that race we're talking about the other day, race in BC, where I had a complete mental breakdown when I got like, I think I got 14th and almost rode my bike home in the rain. So it's just whatever, it's different. You can put yourself in some different positions in bike racing, which I like.
Yeah. So what's the plan for the team this next, you're still riding with?
Yeah, I think I have a good thing.
You signed with a...
I'm talking to my lawyer about that. No, it's my team is just a good place to be, you know, because, I mean, right now, I was thinking about it earlier today, and... You know, so many years of like chasing being a professional, you know, quote unquote professional bike racer. Right now, how it is, pro bike racing in the US, it's not really, it's not real. There's like 3 teams that get paid, and great, that's awesome. You know, keep doing it. But a lot of the teams don't get paid. And I made the realization that it's like, okay, I'm on a great team that I'm really well supported on, you know, and they have a great schedule and I have, you know, a great relationship with everybody. Like, why would I want to be on a different team? why would I want to go be on a, you know, quote unquote pro crit team that might fold in 1 year?
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I could still get the same results on this team, and I can have fun with my friends while I'm doing this. It's like, oh, great. I made the realization. I'm like, oh, I should just stay on this team.
Yeah, and if you're getting a bike and entry fees, you may not be different than some of these guys that are riding the big races.
I'm doing better on this team. Yeah. I know I'm doing better on this team than some of the pro teams.
Yeah,
I'm really looked after. So it's that thing where I have say over what races we do, and we can kind of mold the calendar around what we actually want to do. And I think next year will probably be pretty similar. I don't know.
Are they going to travel? Are you planning on doing that as well again?
Well, I don't know. This year, so I obviously raced a lot, but I also worked as a soigneur for a different team, for Stork CCN. For three of the stage races, I did Gila and I did Redlands and I did Cascade with them. And I think that was just too much travel. All the travel with the team and all the travel working was just too much. So I think I still am going to travel with the team next year and do some of the fun crit trips and stuff that I really enjoy. But I don't think I'll travel for work anymore. I think I'll just limit it.
How was it traveling for another team, probably guys and being this 1 year and not racing? I mean, you're doing, you wouldn't have probably Gila. I mean,
oh gosh,
Gila Monsters.
That's the worst race in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
It's different. It's a big thing. I won't be a Swanee for the team I work for. For the reason is I want to keep it completely different work relationship and rider relationship.
Yeah.
When I'm working for this team, I know everybody, they're Northern California team, and I'm like friends with them. But instead of being, having the different dynamics of being a rider and, working for these people, it's just like I am their Swanee. I'm there to get them food and make sure they're happy and they're appreciative, and it doesn't carry on to the bike.
Yeah.
It's when I get in on my bike and I'm racing against them, there is no, I am just racing them, racing to beat them. So that's why I like working for a different team, as where I feel like, obviously I'm great friends with my teammates, but if I worked for my own team, it takes down the wall of just being an athlete, and maybe the expectations would be different as to what I'm expected to do. I don't want to make water bottles.
Yeah.
If I'm not getting
And you don't want to be at a race as their teammate where you're actually racing, mm-hmm. and them thinking that, oh, well, Willie's here, he can maybe...
massages.
I want,
I'm not going to do that. Yeah. Why would I want to do that?
Yeah. Fill up your own damn bottle.
Exactly. I think that's the big thing. And it was fun, because it is fun to see things differently, to spend all day in the feed zone and really realize how much you can absolutely take advantage, you don't realize how much is going on.
You're a little nicer to your own
staff. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's insane seeing behind the scenes, all the stuff that the director, the mechanic, and the Swanee are doing is insane.
I think that's real important. When I was racing, I was on Oil Me, mm-hmm. and we would get some, we had a proclivity for picking up kind of guys that were at the end of their career, mm-hmm. but they just weren't getting picked up. So they end up coming up with us, and it's a real downgrade from where they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie Gregus, the guys that had won national championships that are suddenly racing for you, and they expect this high quality. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not what they're going to get, because this is just it's a facade. I mean, we have a team and you have big riders, but you don't have much else.
Yeah.
And the expectations, I'm not saying Eddie did that, but there was others, and mm-hmm. the expectations are just outrageous for everybody on the team. Mm-hmm. And it puts a real damper on, I was friends with, the manager and some other people, and then it just the blowback, and you see the pretentiousness of some of the riders.
Yeah.
And that never goes away. The one you never do that to is the mechanic.
Oh yeah.
And that would happen too often, and it just baffled me. But.
Well, that's the thing is you see it, and Phil Laverty, I'm going to talk about you specifically, we had on Spork CCN, there's a lot of guest riders, and you see the people that are used to certain things, like Phil is a really talented bike racer. He rode for Cofidis and Ampost and all these races, and he comes to a smaller team, and he's always extremely professional and all that, but he just expects so many more different things from a local racer who's just like, you're gonna make my water bottles for me? That's fantastic. What great news. As where Phil always expected everything to be exactly where it needs to be, organized, his bike needs to be exactly how he wants it to be. So it's, you get to appreciate what you have once you see it from the how much goes into it.
And there's nothing wrong with expecting those things, you know, as a pro rider or, yeah. you know, a high rider. But I think it's those guys that have been, that they start their career, maybe they've had to work their way up a little bit more, take mm-hmm. care of their own bike, rather yeah. than that kid that, nothing wrong with the kid that's super talented, that yeah. immediately gets everything that. Given to him.
Yeah.
You know, I would do all my own work, mm-hmm. you know, do my own massage, yep. right?
Exactly.
And you know, so, I don't know, maybe he's...
No, it's interesting because you do see that, you know, you see the people that have just had it differently, you know, see the people like maybe like me and, you know, 99% of the rest of cycling is you start a little later and you're used to doing it yourself and you work in a bike shop and, you know, you didn't quite go through like the development ranks, but then you see the people that did go through the junior development ranks and are used to being in Europe and...
And you get that free bike and it's the most amazing thing that's ever happened because...
Exactly. Because you worked really hard and you, like, I remember I bought my first road bike before I started racing and I told myself, I'm not going to buy another bike until someone gives it to me. And that bike got like, it was cracked in three different places. Like everything was broken on it by the time I got my first free
when
bike.
Was your first bike given to you?
It was in 2013.
For
I
which?
Think. It was Leopard.
Okay.
So Leopard gave me just a, I don't know if it's like it as a personal sponsorship kind of thing. So they just
it wasn't with one of the teams.
Then. No, I think we were still a Felt team. This is right when I had gotten on what at the time was Mark Pro Strava. And I think they were still on Felt. I don't think they were getting bikes yet. And I got a Leopard. And it was like the most beautiful thing. It was two sizes too small. I looked like a giant riding a child's bike. But like I was like, oh, okay, I've gotten a bike.
Yeah.
And then from there, I think the next year is when we started getting team bikes. And that was the same thing. I mean, it's like I just get this and I get to ride it for a year. And like, it's fantastic. And now I think it's easy to take for granted. Like, I don't even own a road bike. I just have my team bike. And if I lose that, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know, like, I have no idea. But, yeah, that...
But you appreciate that.
Then, oh, yeah.
You know, it's
absolutely.
The understanding.
I the bike I ride now, it's a super bike.
Yeah.
You know, the KTM I have now, I get to ride these, like, amazing bikes that I wouldn't be able to afford because I'm, you know, like, what, fast enough to get it? Well, that's
yeah.
fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, that's like a dream come true. I feel like you can either, you know, in the cycling world, you can either be fast enough and poor enough, essentially, to get stuff for free, or you can have a nice job and buy it, and you kind of end up in the same middle ground of having nice stuff, just two ways of getting there.
Yeah. So you do your masseuse as well on the side.
Yeah.
You want to plug your business, or is that
I'm moving to Sacramento.
My mom listens to this podcast.
Hey, there you go. So I'm moving my Sacramento office, hopefully this winter. You know, I've been working in Walnut Creek for the last 6 years.
Okay.
But I'm now going to be moving and opening up Sacramento massage office, which would be great. You know, but yeah, I worked as a massage therapist. I started working as a massage therapist at the same time I started being a bike racer.
Were they conjoined? I mean,
they
is
were.
That something that
I
you
wanted,
just kind of...
You know, for me, I always go full into things. So when I started racing bikes, I said, okay, I guess I'm a bike racer now. I need a job that's going to work around bike racing.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine who I... did that long ride to Seattle with to kind of get me into cycling. He was a massage therapist. And I remember one thing he said, just offhand comment. He said, oh, he said he was going to move to Guadalajara or Mexico or something like that. And he was like, something like that, something in Central America or South America. And he's like, oh, because I can, I'm a massage therapist. I can do whatever I want to do. I'm like, maybe I should be a massage therapist.
Hey.
That sounds nice. You know, so I think that, that winter is when I started going to school. And it's a perfect job. I mean, I make my own hours. I have a great office. I get to hang out essentially in a very relaxing room and listen to music and just, you know, make people feel better, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those things, not everybody can be a massage therapist. It's like, I imagine it's kind of like being a dentist where some people just don't want to look in someone's mouth. That's gross to some people.
Because you don't know, I'm touching people.
Exactly. For me,
I mean, it's not all athletes coming in.
Oh, it's almost no athletes.
Yeah.
But for me, it's not weird because I just think of it as a body. Like, I know where the muscles are and I know what they do and I'm going to work on them in that way. So it's not even like I'm touching a human body. I just know how to fix this problem and I'm going to go and work on this muscle and I'm going to fix it. You know, but not everyone can do that. Not everyone can, like, make that not weird for themselves. You know, like, for me, I wouldn't want to be a dentist. Like I said, like, that's...
The mouth and
that's
all.
Weird.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
weird to me.
I come from a family of dentists.
Yeah, and it's just
And I don't
different.
Want to be one either.
Exactly. And it's like,
but I get free toothbrushes.
Hey, there you go. And for me, like, I can work on someone's feet just because I think, okay, what are the muscles in there? Like, yeah. It's not weird to me. And so I just happen to find a job that I like doing that I think I'm good at, and it works with bike racing.
TMJ, have you ever?
I work on a bunch of people with TMJ sculpture.
I do have TMJ, and I'm not asking for free help here. I'm just saying, I went to a massage therapist, and I popped my jaw during the thing. And she said, "Oh, so she started doing some." So what's that all about? She gave me a massage on my jaw.
Yesterday I worked on someone that had TMJ dysfunction, and it's one that I find very interesting. So many people have it, and there's not a lot you can. It's hard to figure out what's going on, because you'll go and you'll see a dentist or something like that, and they'll give you a mouth guard, and it doesn't really solve any of the underlying issues. But I really like working on people because it's you can work on their jaw, and you can work on their head muscles and their neck muscles that connect onto their jaw, and you can see a difference immediately. Like, you can, you know, let's say your left side is popping out and causing you headaches. You can work on it and see a difference after you work on it. They'll open their mouth and the jaw won't come out as bad. Like, all right, cool. Yeah, check. All right, come see me in a week.
Wow, yeah.
You know, so that's one thing I really like is, you know, because my massage is pretty deep and you feel it and you might be sore the next day, but they feel better. You know, people feel better afterwards. And it's not often that, like, the customer service complaints in my line of work is, like, not existent. You know, people are appreciative of what you're doing because you're making them feel better.
And it's instant gratification, so to speak.
Exactly, because even if maybe they're going to be sore, like I mentioned, but they're still going to feel different. They're going to feel better after I work on them. So, I don't know. I feel like it's pretty hard to beat.
That's good in a job. So, I was in court. I'm a family law attorney, and you don't always get wins, right? And very often you don't. And today I had court, and it went great, and that's very satisfying, but... it's just, I don't need to get into my personal life, but
it's
I'm on a high today is what I'm saying, Willie.
Absolutely. I mean, talking to my dad, who is a family law attorney and is in court a lot, we've talked about that. And my girlfriend she's also a lawyer. So she'll talk about her work stresses, which are obviously a lot more than mine. And it's just completely different. Like, what's my work stress is usually not having enough clients. It has nothing to do with my clients.
But that's... I mean, it's all subjective and it's all relative, right? Because not having clients could be worse than having that client that's annoying to you, but they're paying you.
Exactly. That's the thing is, I really like my clients. And I honestly don't think I have any that I dislike. And I think a big thing is I don't talk to my clients in my work. I tell them I'm not going to talk to my clients. They say, hey, sit there, relax, don't talk, just relax. And I think that there's way too many massage therapists that can't handle silence.
Yes.
You know, and as I'm sure you know, like...
I would prefer silence.
Exactly.
It's almost, if my therapist told me that when I go in,
it's so
massage
much,
therapist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
my other problems.
That wouldn't be a good therapist.
Yeah. I just don't want to have any. No, I would probably relax a little better right up front too.
And that's one thing was I'm working on people and they're trying to have they're nervous because they're naked on a table, which I totally understand. But if they're talking to me, you can't relax. I'm trying to move their leg and they're fighting against me. And I just find it way easier to completely disconnect from that. Tell them to breathe and relax and enjoy some music. And they probably can't take a nap because they're going to be in a little bit of pain.
Yeah, yeah.
But it just takes the stress off me and them. So I have had clients that talk a lot. Maybe I've been working on them for years and so that's okay. But... maybe once or twice a year I have a client where I'm just like, I cannot stand this person, you know? But then what do? I just give them to a different therapist.
Yeah.
You know, problem solved.
Yeah.
Work stress over.
So about stress. So when you're on the road, what do you do for, because there's a lot of downtime. I don't know,
there's
book reading, you said you enjoy podcasts. What's kind of your deal? Movies?
I think.
Robin Minimum Security 7-Eleven.
It's a lot of podcasts, a lot of reading, and it's probably even more video games.
Okay.
And so before I was a competitive cyclist, I played video games competitively.
Oh, wow.
It was really...
What'd you play?
I played a game called Guild Wars, and it was just a... I mean, this is 10 years ago, you know, so this is between probably 15 to 18. I played a game that was, you know, an 8-versus-8 kind of video game where there was a lot of team dynamics and all this stuff. So basically what happened is I played with these 7 other people. They were very serious about the game. We played every day. We had team practice. like 4 to 6 hours Monday through Friday, and we tournaments on the weekends. We got really good, and that was my first taste of like the competitive side of things. So, you know, I stopped playing that. It ended up being not good for me because it caused so much stress in my life. So I stopped playing that, but I still play a lot of video games. You know, like if you were with me on a trip, you can ask any one of my teammates what I do with my day. I'll just play video games for like 6 hours a day.
Is there a way to monetize any of that? I see now, you know, I mentioned this PewDiePie guy. I noticed on
there is. There's absolutely.
And he seems to make millions of dollars playing games and saying racial comments.
Exactly. And just being like generally offensive, which seems to work for him.
You're what, Swedish?
Exactly. He's fine. He's doing his thing. But there is. And I've thought about it. And I actually just recently got a computer that can do streaming and all that stuff. But at the same time, like my main reason for playing video games is to not be stressed and to be like, you know, go play a fantasy world where I'm going to go ride my giant chicken into battle and cast magic spells at a dragon. Like that sounds great to me, you know, where I don't have to be worried about like normal life stresses, and not that I have that many, but it's a nice escape. And
when do you role play? Do you dress up and go to?
No, I haven't. That's, you know, that's something God bless them, you know, but I'm still somewhat rooted in reality.
You have a girlfriend, you did
say. I know, exactly. So I actually got her to play video games with me for a little bit, but so far I haven't been able to like wear fake cat ears and like pretend I'm a cat and a sorcerer or whatever. But when I'm traveling for races, I always have my laptop, and you know, some days, especially in when you're doing a big crit trip, like Tour of America's Dairyland, it was 11 days, and we race for 90 minutes a day. It's usually about 7:30 in the evening, and it's almost expected that you're going to rest and you're going to, you know, take it seriously and all this stuff, so you don't want to be going hiking and all that stuff. So you have like 9 hours a day of just sedentary, doing whatever, you know. So I kind of have the habit of just kind of disappearing into my video games or disappearing into a book or whatever I happen to be doing, because I'm very okay with being by myself and like being in a quiet space and kind of, I'm a social guy. I enjoy talking to people, but at the same time,
you're comfortable like, being alone.
Yeah, I'm totally okay.
You enjoy solitary training. I mean, I'm kind of the same way. Yeah. And sometimes it's just, if I'm not listening to something, you're like going over things in your head. And
I got enough things going on in my head where I need some alone time to kind of unwind.
Flush it out.
Yeah. So I do a lot. I would say I do 90% of my writing by myself. And for me, that is needed, you know, because, yeah, coffee rides and training with your friends in the off season and doing those big days are really great because you get to
socialize.
Yeah. But it can also be like kind of exhausting because when I'm riding, maybe I'll have a podcast in, or maybe I have some whatever personal things to deal with. So I'll go and ride 5 hours and you get back and you're like, all right, I've had some good time to think about possible thing.
Do you ever have stress that kind of debilitates you on the bike, like overwhelming? Some people get mad and they just like really are aggressive, and I get to the point when it's happening that it's almost like sucks my wind out and I'm just like, I can't do it.
I think I go the opposite way. So I used to just be, oh man, the most angsty, just angry individual when I was a little younger. And I still get like bouts of just like of rage for whatever reason. And I'll go out and just smash just as hard as I can for a couple hours on the bike, you know, and just absolutely obliterate myself. And I feel better afterwards. Like, oh, that was good. I needed that.
Therapeutic.
Exactly. And I've been at races where to psych yourself up, you just get mad. You get like...
Yeah, those don't work with me.
That is definitely how I work. Especially in races, especially in the final few laps, or even during the race, you can't talk to me in a lot of races because I am just so... I'm going to beat everyone. I'm going to just destroy everyone. And I use that to kind of fuel, like, I just get really mad at everyone around me. And
note to Tyler, don't talk to Will.
Which makes me, like, I have really close friends that'll try to talk to me in a bike race. And I just, lips are sealed.
How are you right after the line? I mean, I've known some friends that, you know, if it didn't go right, you just know not to even approach them.
Yeah.
And well, I'm like, hey, jovial, da-da-da.
I'm usually pretty good, you know. Especially, so going back with Garrett is like a really close friend of mine. We I met him when he was, I was 19, I think he was like 15, as Cat 5s. And we've raced together, we've trained together, we've traveled together so much. Like, we're such good friends that there have been many races where either I'll win and he'll get second, or he'll win and I'll get second. And we give each other about, you know, maybe a day of space. You know, because not that you're angry at the other person,
well, you
just wanted to win so bad. Yeah. And then we'll get coffee the next day and it's like nothing happened. Everything's fine. You know, it's, but for me, I'm usually pretty okay. Except for that BC,
yeah,
you know, thing. But most races I'm okay with. This year, me and Matt Chat as teammates had a little, not a dust up, but we kind of got into it after a race a little bit. Just because I didn't finish how I wanted to. And I decided to take that out on my teammate, as you do. You know, so it doesn't happen often, but sometimes I lose it.
Are you good at having some introspection of, you know, saying it was your fault, or you're mad, or is it you're just a dick to him?
I'm usually pretty good with communication. Usually in races, my teammates will know what is happening, what I want. And sometimes I don't do that well, but a lot of times that's where the frustration comes from, is maybe I didn't communicate well and something didn't go right, and it's on me, and I'm mad at myself, and it's hard to get past that. But in 99% of races, I'm a happy guy even after the race. Even if I lost, it's fine. You know, I was at Jackson, I was off the back, and the guy I was riding with three guys, and we're just chatting, having a good time, and it's fine. It's local bike racing. You're just trying to have a good time, you know. But I remember my first P12 race. I got yelled at in the sprint by my teammate, and it was the Auburn crit, and it just like destroyed me. Like, I was so mentally devastated because I thought I had ruined everything, and I went and hid in a corner and, you know, didn't come out for like a day. I don't think I do that as much anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's probably good, but you know, the more your teammates get to know you, the better.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
I remember yelling at Andrew Shimizu at the Auburn crit, and that was actually because he wasn't going down the hill fast enough, and it was gapping me. But it's because I sucked to the point where I was back too far, so I didn't want to be gapped.
Mm-hmm.
And he was good enough to, he'd just scoot back up on the climb, and it was no big deal. But you know, so it was really my own anger.
Oh yeah,
at myself. But he's causing a gap, so I've got to yell at him.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I know. Yeah, the yelling at teammates, especially during races, can sound a lot worse than it is. Like, I only have one level of voice in races, and that's really loud. I'm yelling at these people. Yeah. And even if I'm not angry at you, it's going to sound like I'm just going to, like, chew your head off. It's like, no, that's just how I talk in races. You know, so I've many times had to apologize to people after race. Like, hey, I wasn't mad at you.
Yeah, but that's important.
Yeah, I wasn't
as long as you're not throwing bottles.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I don't think I've ever done that.
I haven't thrown one. I've squirted a bottle at a guy before because he was being
I thought about it. When I crashed at Davis, I was so mad at the guy. I was staying in the middle of the road, and all I could think of was, like, what can I throw at this person? But then I'm like, okay, I'm in front of all these people that are watching the race. I'm also run the risk of hitting someone that has nothing to do with it. So I'm like, all right, let's calm down a little bit and not throw a water bottle. Be a little more reserved, you know, but most of the time I'm a happy camper.
Yeah, 90%. No, and that's why I wanted to talk to you, and I appreciate it. My battery's going to head out here, okay. So we're going to be done, but
yeah,
no, you are a happy camper, and you're always fun to have on the rides, and you know, you bridge this gap lately of this river ride and the Coffee Republic Folsom ride, and you're a peacekeeper.
Yeah. And I feel like it's a shame that we don't have more people, because the dynamic is so different.
It's different, but I for me, it's all a convenience thing. And I'll try to do this in the winter for some speed, go down there. You know, it's 100 miles, ride from my house, do that, come back, 100 feet of climbing?
Exactly.
Or, you know, leave like 5 minutes from my house, and I've got, you know, 3,000 feet in 50 miles.
I feel like...
But they're great, both different. They're just different.
Really different. I feel like, as a river rider, in the river ride, you attack nonstop because you can get back in. It's flat.
Yeah.
You know, so you're just used to attacking your brains out. As where you go and you try to bring that into the, like, the Coffee Republic ride, it's just different. You can attack your brains out, then you're probably going to have a bad time on a ridge. So people play completely different. So if I feel like if you can bring those two, like, Sacramento communities together You can get them all to come do the Sacramento, the South River Ride, which is the best group ride.
I've never done that one, and so I need to show up and do those.
There's like two left.